For a couple of years of my life, I had the great privilege of studying with a really epical landmark Jewish scholar named Amos Funkenstein, who was a scholar not only of the history of science, but also of Judaica, and wrote important essays in Hebrew and in English and inspired a generation of students. And among his many virtues was a great deal of personal charm, and among his many faults was an absolute inability to know what time it was. Professor Funkenstein would say, "I will meet you at my office at 11, and at 12:30 he would come sauntering up full of smiles and apologies and quotations in 6 different languages, and it was impossible to stay angry with him until the next time you were waiting in front of his office for him to show up. And once he asked me to drive him to the airport. So I said, of course, Professor, I'd be honored. I'll be happy to drive you to the airport. I don't know what time his flight was. Maybe it was at noon. I told him, listen, we can't leave any later than, whatever, 10:30, I don't know. And 11:15 goes by, 11:30 comes by, about 25 minutes before his flight is about to take off, he shows up, and I'm sweating. And he doesn't care. He gets into the car, he says everything will be fine, he subjects me to another one of his faults, which was that he smoked consistently. And as we're driving there, and I'm terrified, of course, that he's going to miss his flight, he starts a long disquisition on the history of watches and clocks. He was trained at, Heidelberg or Berlin, in Heidelberg or Berlin, so of course he knew all about keeping time and being precise because he'd studied at German universities. This is irrelevant to the subject, to the story, but it's kind of interesting. When he was young, he was best friends with Adin Steinsaltz. Adin Steinsaltz was secular as a child, and Funkenstein was ultra-Orthodox. As they got older, they reversed, and even though they stayed very close friends, Steinsaltz, of course, became a renowned ultra-Orthodox scholar, and Funkenstein completely secular. Anyway, so he started to tell me, he said, you know, before the invention of the counterpoise clock in Germany in, I think, the 15th century, said nobody could be 5 minutes late. And I thought, you know, the airline is not going to buy that one. Because he said there were no timepieces accurate enough to make someone 5 minutes late. You could be an hour late, but you couldn't be 5 minutes late. And I bring all this up as a circuitous way of reminding us how arbitrary time really is. I'm not speaking about time in some absolute sense or in some Einsteinian sense. I mean as we experience it. Really, driving with him in the car would have been the same if it was 5 minutes later or 5 minutes earlier. It was only the fact that I was looking at the clock that told me that we might be late. He, by the way, made the plane. I know you're concerned about that, but of course he did. But the truth is that even though biologically we feel time in our bodies, we get older, and even though if you don't live in Los Angeles, you feel it in the world, the seasons change. I'm told. You've been outside today? It's January. The truth is we mark time very arbitrarily. You know that in the Jewish calendar there are 4 New Years. I mean, what are we doing with 4 New Years? It's because our sense of time, the reality is it's arbitrary. Shabbat, is it built into the structure of the world? Somebody put you in a room for a couple of weeks, you wouldn't know which day was Shabbat. Your sense of time passing would be stripped of externals and you'd realize how arbitrary it was. So when we say Happy New Year, could have said it 2 days ago, 5 days ago, 2 weeks from now, but we need the markers of time, not because they're accurate in terms of time, but because they're important in terms of our lives. It matters that it was New Year's. It wasn't the Jewish New Year's, but it matters that it was New Year's, even though almost every scholar will tell you that this New Year's is based on things that are historically inaccurate and were mashed up through the years, and it doesn't matter. because New Year's is an opportunity to do something that we need to do. And in order to understand what that is, we can look even at this morning's Torah reading. Why does Jacob bless his children? Well, you can offer several theories. One theory, of course, modern scholarship would say that the subsequent histories of the tribes were then retrojected back onto Jacob's blessing, and he predicted things that people already knew had come true. But that doesn't help us. It doesn't really help us to say that Jacob is predicting the future of the tribes. In fact, the commentators are very uncomfortable with the idea that Yaakov would predict the future, because you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to tell people what will happen to them, certainly, if you know. And how would Jacob really know? And doesn't that take away the element of free will from people if you tell them certainly that this will happen to you or that will happen to you? So there is a third possibility, which is that Jacob was using the blessing the way we do. Jacob was blessing his children in order that his children feel blessed. When you bless someone, the first thing you do is you give them an added velocity. They move faster. It's like taking a running start at a leap. You're saying to them, here, I'm giving you a head start. I'm giving you a blessing, which you ought to know will carry you at least a little bit further into the future. That's what we hope a blessing does. And it also remains as a touchstone when you remember how you were blessed. The words that were spoken. The sense that someone wished to bless you, that can last a lifetime. It is a renewable source of personal energy. And then, of course, there's the fact that we believe that in some intangible, undefinable, but real sense, a blessing calls forth power in the world that wouldn't be there in the absence of that blessing. And so for all these reasons, Jacob knows that his responsibility as a father, when he sees his children for the last time, is to offer them a blessing so that they can carry it forward into their lives. And of course, because the echoes of blessings continue to reverberate generation to generation in the lives of their children and their children's children. And that's why you ought to make resolutions. Because resolutions are blessings that you offer to yourself. When you say to yourself, I'm going to do this, you give yourself a little bit added velocity, a little bit of a push that is absent if you say, I'm not going to even bother to think about it. Not only that, but you remember those resolutions later on. In a week, in a month, in a year, you remember, you know, I promised I was going to do this. And maybe in some way, it calls some power into the world, at least in the sense that William James talked about it, where he said that the greatest discovery of humanity was that a change in attitude creates a change in reality. That was James' essay on the will to believe, where he talked about the fact that, in terms of velocity, that if you come to a chasm and you have to leap over it, that the belief that you can will help create the reality that you will. Now, you might say, if you were of a cynical disposition, that more important than your attitude is the length of the chasm, but James is making a point that we all acknowledge to be true, which is that we are not unlimited. I can't fly no matter how much I wish I could, but that there's a tremendous elasticity to our powers in the world that can actually change things if we believe we can change them. And that you don't know the limits of that elasticity unless you push it again and again, and even then how many of us ever really come up against our limits. So I wanted this morning to urge you to resolutions, and I have three different areas, easily enough intuited, but I'll say them anyway, of resolutions that you ought to think about, or that I hope you will think about in the world. And the first is a resolution about yourself, to change something. Do you know the story of Reb Chaim Halberstam, who, when he was young, decided to change the world, and then he realized that the world was actually a very big place? So he thought, you know what, I'm going to be modest, I'm just going to change my city. But his city also was complicated and interconnected and resistant to change, and so he decided, you know what, I'm older now, I understand, I'm going to change my family. But now his kids were a little grown, and his wife knew him a little too well. And when he discovered he couldn't change his family, he said, now I'm an old man, and I realize I better start with myself. So you start with yourself. Pick something about your life that you can make a little better. You don't have to swing for the fences, just a little better. Something that you don't do that you know you should do. And promise yourself that you will do it, maybe not every day, but once a week, twice a week. Some resolution that will improve you and, on the way, will also encourage you, I hope, to make a resolution on behalf of our people. Do something for the Jewish people that you hadn't done last year, whether it is contributing to an organization in terms of your time or your money, or learning, but not alone, with someone else. Something that helps the Jewish people. Just because the new year isn't the Jewish new year doesn't mean that the Jewish people shouldn't get something out of it. And finally, we live in a beleaguered and benighted world. There is almost unfathomable amounts of pain and suffering and need. And none of us does what we can for those who are so far less blessed than anyone in this room. And surely, since this is an opportunity to give our characters a little bit of an extra push, we shouldn't only resolve to change ourselves and the Jewish people, but to do something for the world that needs us so desperately. And none of those things you will discover, remarkably enough, none of those things will steal away other things that you care about or other things that you love. You're not allowed to use as an excuse, I will look to the problems of the world when the problems of the Jewish people are solved. Because the problems of the Jewish people, I'll tell you a small secret, will never be solved. Not because we're Jews, but because we're people. And people will always have problems. And if you wait until one set of problems is definitively solved before you tackle the second, you will paralyze yourself in this world. And you can philanthropically multitask. You can help yourself, the Jewish people, and the world. Any one of those three would make a worthy resolution, but all three together would be using an arbitrary slice of time to make your life and other lives better. Let me close where I began. As long as I mentioned Professor Funkenstein, let me tell you what his greatest scholarly legacy was. He argued, in terms of Jewish history, not in terms of his work of history of science, he argued that our view of the Jewish people as powerless was a big mistake. That in fact, throughout history, Jews have exercised power in all sorts of ways. David Beale's book, Power and Powerlessness in Jewish History, was based on Funkenstein's work. Beale was one of his students. And Funkenstein taught this because, after all, he wanted to say that even though in the modern world we tend to think of Jewish power in terms of the state of Israel, and that that's important and vital and central to Jewish life, it wasn't the only form of Jewish power. Funkenstein had the sort of unique position of teaching half the year at Tel Aviv University and half the year in the UC system, because he really believed that both centers of Jewish power were important and vital and could be used in many, many different ways. And they can. You have tremendous power in this world. You can leave here today and change someone's life tonight. You can do it. You know you can. Somebody who is hungry or homeless or alone. So, now in violation of my teacher's strictures, let me just tell you that it all has to do with not wasting your time. It all has to do with cherishing your time. It is the most precious and finite of our resources. And in the year ahead, however you define the year ahead, I hope that you will find something to do that will elevate your soul and improve your life. Something that will enliven, inspirit, enrich, strengthen the Jewish people. And also, something that will help someone who needs your help, whom you can help, whom you might save. If you do that, then, in the fashion that we say, it will be a Shana Tova, a good year. But I also think it'll probably be a happy one. Shabbat Shalom.